World Tomorrow, as recorded before a live audience in Pasadena, California, Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
They said in San Francisco in 1945, what they were doing there was the world's last hope for world peace. What is your opinion of the body which is now called United Nations, standing above the East River in New York City? A very large hassle is shaping up as a result of the Third World Non-Aligned Nations' intention to make the United Nations yet an additional hollow sounding board of communistic and Third World Non-Aligned propaganda. And as we see, newer nations and even non-nations becoming a part of the United Nations and having a voice in its proceedings, we see the folly, the shame, the utter ignominy of that world body as it fails continually to either stop wars from occurring, to shorten a war once it has gotten started, or to stop wars once they have begun, short of the determination of the participants to bring about some solution. Now you have to remember in 1945, 1946, that the world in that time was a completely different world than it is today. We had not gotten used to the notion of the atomic bomb by 1946. Europe was in absolute ashes. The cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were burnt blights and blotches in what once had been an area of vast cities. Over 11 million people had died in the Soviet Union alone. Over 6 million Jews had been herded into Belsen, Auschwitz, Dachau, and Buchenwald. The world had been soaked in the blood of millions from the South Pacific to the North Atlantic. Hundreds upon hundreds of ships were being tossed back and forth by the surge of tidal action deep beneath the seas all around the world where the bodies of men are still to this day. And humanity was sick to death and tired to its soul of waging war that rampaged up and down the length and breadth of the entirety of the world and took the lives of uncounted, perhaps, millions of human beings. World War II grew out of the tattered shards of man's attempt to legislate against a new round of war. That attempt was called the League of Nations, and its most important instrument was called the Treaty of Versailles. But the death knell of the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles was built into its charter. The destruction of the Treaty of Versailles was assured by the signature on the dotted line at the end of the treaty. They created the Danzig Corridor. They stripped from Germany its East African colonies of what are now Kenya and Tanzania and other nations, then called Tanganyika. They took away from the Germans their South Pacific island holdings of the Marshalls and the Gilberts. They created U.S. and Japanese mandates in that area. Later on, when Hitler, as a demagogue, came to power and began to create a mystery religion, a religion of state, a religion of race, a religion of culture, a religion of militarism, he railed and flailed away in the streets from Munich to the city of Berlin about the injustices, about the inequality that was built into the Treaty of Versailles, a division that kept Germanic peoples apart from the sea gate to the North Baltic port of Danzig. He talked about stripped possessions and lost territories, the Sudetenland, Czechoslovakia. It was ready fair for any individual who wished to hold the promise of grandeur, either a square deal, a new deal, a great deal, a grand society, or a great design, or a grand design, as other great leaders have come up with from time to time, and to cause the German people to rally behind the cry of a strong, powerful leader who promised them, godlike, practically everything God promises in the Bible. Governments tend to do that, you know. They tend to play God. They tend to promise people what only God says he can deliver. Absence of disease. They have consumer protection agencies. Government inspections of our food, our air, and our water. They have Medicaid and Medicare. They have socialized medicine. They will give you long life because they will protect your health. They will guarantee safe working conditions, and they will, of course, impose sanitation laws. They will give you plenty of happiness, a chicken in every pot, some of them have promised, a car in every garage, a job for every working man. They're still promising these things even today. Rulers, whether despotic or democratic, always, it seems, tend to promise the people the same things. They promise plenty to the Square Deal back many years ago in the United States, to the New Deal more recently under Roosevelt, to the Raw Deal that everybody got under a recent administration. They promise the grand design, the great society, and plans of government are supposed to usher in the new utopian era, where peace, plenty, happiness, prosperity, lots of fun in the sun, a new automobile for everybody is, of course, what you're going to get out of it. What Hitler promised the people of West Germany, the United States now enjoys. He promised them all a Volkswagen. Hitler helped design it, you know. If that had been publicized in the early 1950s, the Volkswagen out of Wolfsburg would have been an absolute flop in the United States. And it would have been in Britain. It's what led that Bailey that Lord Beaverbrook owns in England to say the Volkswagen seems about ready to do to us what Hitler's submarines could not do in World War II. The little Beetle, the familiar automobile that so many millions of Americans own, is the design Adolf Hitler drew on a piece of paper. Adolf Hitler was one of his designers. It was what he promised the German people. A car in every garage. Well, World War II grew out of the shattered shards, the torn rubble that was the Treaty of Versailles. Will World War III grow out of the rubble that is the United Nations? You have to ask whether or not this world is in a crisis of government, and note how many governments have toppled in the last few years. The governments of West Germany, of Britain, of the United States, of Japan. Governments of the major nations around the world have been toppled by spy scandals, by scandals in its highest echelon, such as that in the United States, that in West Germany, that in Britain. They have been toppled from within. They have been overthrown by coup d'etats. There have been governments toppling around the world, even to the extent that tiny Iceland is also toppled. Now, as you look at the spectacle of the domino effect on world governments, of governments disintegrating, toppling, failing time after time. Many nations, such as Italy, for example, have had more governments since the end of World War II than there are years since the end of World War II. More than one government per year. And the nation is still totally bankrupt and unable to solve its problems. I think you read about the morass of the Italian mail system of soldiers wading up to their knees in undelivered letters, finding out that even government checks had lain in warehouses for months and years and had never been delivered. An absolute shambles, a choking, stifling, chaotic inability of governments to promise and to deliver to their people any form of decent, regulated life. Now, increasingly, according to some geopoliticians, nation after nation begins to cry out for strong leadership. In the United States of America, there is a fervent desire in people's hearts by the millions for a strong leader. They want a leader who inspires vision, a leader who inspires courage, conviction, confidence, dedication, and faith. They want a man in whom they can place trust. Even though the Bible says, put not your faith in man, trust no man, the average individual wants to trust his leader. Now, since the United States and many other countries, Japan and all the rest of them, kickbacks from Lockheed, what have you, have been taken through in recent times, within the last decade, the agony of total distrust toward government, the whole world, virtually, has learned to be very, very apprehensive about figures and institutions and government. The United States is no different, with its 70 million dropout voters who simply will not go to the polls, because neither of the presidential hopefuls had turned them on that much, and it's easy to see why. There was no great, strong, powerful, charismatic leader. Men who stand for positions in government tend to wonder which way the wind blows. They put out surveys, they send scouts, they have their feelers out in the general public, they try to please the Catholics on the abortion issue, they try to please labor on the job and guaranteed lower minimum wage and guaranteed vacations and higher pay and workers' benefits and a job for every man and on all those issues. They try to please the consumer on taxes. They try to please the person who is an ultra-rightist and wants a strong defense by saying they will have a strong defense. Then they try to please that same person who wants small government by telling them they're going to reduce government and give government back to the people. And that means lowering the defense budget. They say that they are in favor of small government. They say that they're in favor of taking on Washington and bringing Washington down to the size of Podunk. But at the same time, they promise the consumer all sorts of new programs for welfare, for the poverty-stricken, for the poor, the maimed, the halt, and the blind, Medicaid, Medicare, the administration of food stamps, all sorts of cradle-to-the-grave socialized programs to give you what you can't provide for yourself. The day you lose your job, you get in line down to the unemployment agency and get your check anyhow. But at the same time, the consumer does not want to find out that the individuals who are administering those food stamp and poverty programs have got their elbows in the tills. And so they want someone to regulate that agency. They scream for less bureaucracy and more programs. But you can't have the programs without the bureaucracy. And any time you put a lot of government checks and government money within the reach of any average human being walking our streets, you might as well say you just put a mouse in with the cheese. Because he's going to have an awful time keeping his hands off of it. That's recent history. You can't really blame the politicians for being expedient, because it seems to be the nature of politics that the whole battle is not what is right, what is principle, what is honest, fair, just, and true, but what will get you elected. And the most important thing to the party is to get the man elected, and then we will start dealing with the problems. Now, in order to do that, you promise everybody everything. And so no wonder the populations are a little bit confused. How far has mankind in his attempts to govern and to rule himself come from savagery when you get right down to it? There have been fistfights in past years in Congress. There has been practically no world body, whether a religious conclave to a political one, that has not disintegrated within moments to that same era of Stone Age flint and knives as we had apparently, at least so they tell us, progressed from in recent years. The major things that divide the human race are still with us today. Tribalism, group instincts, racism, language, culture, religion, politics, the way you look, the way you talk, the way you dress, the color of your skin. All of this is summed up, really, in the words human nature. And human nature is vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed, and you can wrap it all up in the one little three-letter word, ego. It is the great I. Ego, the assertion of the worth of self. It's no mistake that God's Ten Commandments place the first one where it is, thou shalt have no other gods before me, because each one of us inherently within ourselves are a potential self-worshipper. That's what ego is all about. Self-aggrandizement, self-determination, self-preservation, self-interest, self-perpetuation, self-domination, self-determination. I will rule myself, I will decide for myself, I will make up my own mind. I am the final authority unto myself. When that becomes a policy of national government, it results in what Hitler created. Is there any real difference today between a gun pointed at your head or a stone axe poised over your head? They're both going to do exactly the same thing, except one just takes a little longer and maybe a little more painful. But mankind has not come very far from the Dark Ages. So far as the need for right, just, honest government is concerned, point to the one government or the one governing body on the face of the earth that has ever yet given its people what it promised. The United Nations, when they formed the Charter in 1946 in San Francisco, acknowledged among the leaders of the world that were gathered there looking at the ashes of the world in Europe and around the world where cities had virtually disappeared, had now faced the fact that the world was going to become nuclear armed. That we had actually entered an age where the extermination of humankind had become a possibility, if not yet a probability. They recognized that what they were doing there was man's last hope for world peace. And they tried to formulate one more of these documents having to do with a general assembly of all of the smaller nations of the world, then having to do with a security council of the larger and the more powerful nations of the world that had emerged victorious and powerful, that had the largest armies, that had the most viable economies, that had the heaviest industrial base following World War II. Unfortunately, they gave each member of that Security Council a veto. And Russia, with that veto, managed to create a complete shambles out of the United Nations all the way through the Cold War years of the 1950s. Now, hiding behind the cloak of détente, issuing their official statements continually that they're a peace-loving people, the Soviet Union has managed to grow beyond parity, beyond equality, beyond balance, in nuclear strategic superiority. Apparently, two huge new developments that I've spoken of recently have completely, totally altered the United States of America's defense posture. Our whole world has dwelt under the shadow of a nuclear bomb since 1950, when it was revealed the Soviet Union had exploded a hydrogen bomb. And from that time on, Washington never made a decision without consulting Moscow first. If not directly, then through its intelligence agencies to find out what would be their reaction. But we were assuming in our military hierarchies in the Pentagon that we should pursue the policy of accepting a massive Soviet strategic nuclear blow and of being able to instantly deal the Soviet Union such unacceptable massive retaliation that nuclear war was rendered unthinkable. No sane human being, but you have to wonder, are human beings, especially sometimes governmental leaders, if you think back to Hitler and Mussolini, always sane? But our policy was that no sane human being would even think of waging nuclear war. And so we gradually built up our missile systems. They became bigger and more effective. They never did achieve the superiority in the amount of tonnage that they could boost off the launching pads, as did the Soviet Union, any more than our society has managed to create a fighter aircraft superior to the Russian Foxbat, captured when the Russian pilot defected and flew it to Japan. I don't know why that is true. I don't know why the United States could not produce during World War II a torpedo as superior as the Japanese aircraft, machine guns, even small arms delivered to our troops anywhere near as competitive or superior as those delivered to the Germans. Maybe it's just because we are not, at heart, a war-loving, a war-making people. Maybe it's because our minds do not really go toward the military until they have to, but then again, people could argue that, couldn't they, when they point out that the United States is the largest trafficker in arms that the world has ever known. But apparently we have now to completely rethink our defense posture. Our Minuteman ballistic missile system is apparently archaic and antique, yet it is the front line of American defense. It is our retaliatory capacity to render the Soviet Union virtually uninhabitable. But now we find the Soviet Union has apparently broken through with a mobile radar system that it can relocate from time to time and place in rings of defensive perimeters around its major populous centers, which would render about 90% of the Russian populace impervious to our Minuteman or our Poseidon Polaris system attack. Our defense has been based upon those two major systems, the Minuteman land-based system and the Poseidon Polaris nuclear submarine system. Those have apparently now been rendered virtually archaic by new developments in the Soviet Union. So we're going to be seeing a great deal of excitement in the Pentagon of rethinking and reshaping American defense posture. Meanwhile, that great body that was formulated in the shards and the aftermath of World War II, called the United Nations, is, I believe, one of the most hollow shells, one of the most ineffective, fruitless, chaotic, bizarre mistakes the world has ever seen. I have suggested time and time again that the United States buy the building and then turn around and sell it to the Arabs for about four times the amount we paid for it, and then, the way they do to American oil companies, nationalize it and take all the money back. There ought to be some way to either just withdraw from the stupidity and the sham of the United Nations. How many Daniel Moynihans are we going to burn out and cause to resign because they simply can't stand it, or for whatever reasons there are, leave the United Nations? How many times do we have to listen to speeches which are so eloquent, so to the point, so straight to the core and the heart, and hear the useless retaliation by some member from perhaps Entebbe, Uganda, who claims that everything the Israeli ambassador has said is a group of lies? Recently, after the spectacle of the segregation, the selection process of the Jewish people at Uganda, when I think every Jew in the entirety of the world must have been chilled to his soul to realize that once again, a military dictatorship had in its possession a group of Jewish hostages. And it was saying, "You Gentiles, walk over here, and the Jews will remain behind." There was not a human being with any recollection whatsoever of World War II who did not see the implications of what was going on at Entebbe. Immediately after the Israelis flew down there in one of the most unbelievable commando raids that you have ever read of, acting the way the United States used to act years and years before. One of the lines in our own Marine Corps hymn that talks about to the shores of Tripoli, which calls to memory the days when Arab pirates tried to exact totally unheard of and unreasonable tariffs and simple piracy against U.S. shipping lanes, and where the United States, no matter how far from our own shores, would send U.S. Marines to take care of the problem. That's exactly what the Jewish people did at Entebbe. And they rescued all of those people, save Mrs. Dora Bloch, of whom it was said by a British who went to the hospital, the 75-year-old lady was carried kicking and screaming from the hospital by a group of the Ugandan soldiers and has never been heard of since. Mrs. Dora Bloch became quite an arguing point in the United Nations. One of the most blistering indictments I have ever heard and one of the most eloquent speeches I have read recently was that attack against the United Nations by its Israeli representative, Chaim Herzog, ambassador to the UN, who gave the following speech, which is published in this book called 90 Minutes at Entebbe. He gave this speech in the United Nations as a reply to the charges being levied against the Israelis that they had been guilty of an act of aggression by rescuing those hostages at Entebbe. He identifies himself, Chaim Herzog, ambassador to the United Nations. From a purely formal point of view, this meeting arises from a complaint brought against the government of Israel. However, let me make it quite clear that sitting here as the representative of the government of Israel, as I have the honor to do, I am in no way sitting in the dock as the accused party. On the contrary, I stand here as an accuser on behalf of free and decent people in this world. I stand here as an accuser against the forces of evil which have unleashed a wave of piracy and terrorism which threatens the very foundations of human society. I stand here as an accuser of all those evil forces which in their inherent cowardice and abject craven attitude see blameless wayfarers and innocent women and children, yes, even babes in arms, a legitimate target for their evil intentions. I stand here as an accuser of the countries that, because of evil design or lack of moral backbone, have collaborated with these bloodthirsty terrorists. I stand here as an accuser of all those in authority throughout the world who, for reasons of cynical expediency, have collaborated with terrorism. I stand here as an accuser of this world organization, the United Nations, which has been unable, because of the machinations of the Arab representatives and their supporters, to coordinate effective measures in order to combat the evil of world terrorism. I stand here as an accuser of those delegations to this organization which, for reasons of political expediency, have remained silent on this issue, an issue which is bound to affect every country in this organization. In so doing, they have themselves become accomplices. Seated in the dock today with the accusing finger of enlightened world opinion directed against them are the terrorist organizations which are plaguing this world and whose representatives have in the past been seated here by this world body with rights equal to those of member states. In the dock are all those countries which have collaborated with the terrorists and which have aided and abetted them. There stand here accused those countries which have blocked every international move to deal with this plague of terror which besets the world. In the dock before us stand all those countries, they are all too numerous, that cry to the high heavens when they're affected by terrorists, that fulminate at this Security Council table when their citizens or diplomats are threatened, and that remain silent when the same happens to citizens of other countries. Some of them do not even have the doubtful grace to remain silent. They have the wicked effrontery to join in condemnation of a country which tries to prevent these acts. In the dock before us stand the representatives of all those countries which stood and applauded the entry into the hall of the General Assembly of a gun-toting terrorist who, according to the President of Sudan, personally gave the order to execute the African, or the American rather, and Belgian diplomats who were bound hand and foot in the basement of the Saudi Arabian Embassy in Khartoum on 1 March 1973. Yes, before us stands accused this rotten, corrupt, brutal, cynical, bloodthirsty monster of international terrorism and all those who support it in one way or the other, whether by commission or omission. Facing them today are the ordinary, decent human beings throughout the world who seek nothing more than to live a life free from terror and from intimidation, free from the threats of hijackers, the indiscriminate bombs of terrorists, and the blackmail of criminals and murderers. Israel's action at Entebbe, in order to release its hostages, has given rise to a worldwide wave of support and approval, such as has rarely ever been seen from every continent, including Africa, from every walk of life, from countries hostile as well as friendly to Israel. The ordinary man and woman in the street have risen behind us and proclaimed enough to this specter of terror, have cried out enough to this world body of pontificating diplomats in which on so many occasions moral cowardice and cynical expediency have combined to drag it down to the depths to which it is plunged. In more ways than one, this organization is in the accused stand today. Mankind will judge it by its behavior on this occasion. Because never has the issue been clearer. Never has the issue been so clear-cut. There will be no excuse in history for this body or for the constituent members of this body if it fails to condemn terrorism. The issue before this body is not what Israel did at the Entebbe airport. The issue before this body is its own future in the eyes of history. That body fails to condemn terrorism. It would not condemn Israel on the one hand because the third world non-aligned nations insisted that it should. Neither would it condemn terrorism on the other hand. That to me was one of the most eloquent speeches I have ever read and to me is a fitting epitaph for what looks like a tombstone on the East River in New York City called the United Nations. The United Nations represented mankind's last hope. And if that is true, then I say mankind's last hope has gone, and that there is no more hope in the human realm and the human sphere for world peace.
This topic will be continued on the next edition in series of The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong. You're invited to learn more about these important issues through the pages of Good News magazine. In addition to his many speaking engagements, Garner Ted Armstrong also serves as editor of Good News magazine. This full-color monthly publication underscores the importance of biblical understanding in modern 20th century living. The Good News magazine. Your subscription is free of charge. There is no cost or obligation. The Good News. You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.